One of the tools of musicianship is learning other instruments besides your primary instrument. And our guest today has learned 3/4 of the instruments that you find in an orchestra. And we're going to chat with him about his technique for learning new instruments and much more coming up next. Hello and welcome to the Musician Toolkit, episode 65. My name is David Lane, and it is great to be with you once again. I hope all of you are doing well today, whatever day this is that you're checking out this podcast episode. It's hard to believe we're on episode 65 already. It literally seems like just yesterday that I began this podcast, but it has been over 14 months since episode number one. First of all, if you're new to this podcast, if this is your first episode, welcome. Thank you so much for checking this out in the sea of so many podcasts out there. I'm glad that you're taking a chance on something new. This is a podcast that is meant to help you grow as a musician. So if you're a music student, or even if you're a professional musician, this is a podcast worth checking out. One of the things I think is really great about our guest today, and I'll tell you more about him in just a minute, but more than once, he talks about the attitude of always listening and learning something new. And I think that this is a trait of your top musicians. They don't come to a podcast like this and they say, I know everything already. There's nothing left to learn. But whether it's through hearing other people talk about music, whether it's reading books on music, or whether it's in the case of what we're going to talk about, just listening to other musicians around you, the openness to realizing that there's always something else that you can learn is actually one of the tools of musicianship. If you have listened to this podcast before, you've heard me mention more than once that I have another podcast that is inactive, quote unquote retired, never say never, but for the most part retired, and it's called Life in the Pit. It's about theater musicians. And for the third time in this podcast's history, I have a repeat guest. In other words, I have a guest that I had featured on Life in the Pit that I'm now featuring for the first time on the Musician Toolkit. And it is a local colleague and longtime friend, Ron Ford. One of the things that I asked him on Life in the Pit, and I believe that is episode 15, whatever I say in the interview, that's more correct. I looked it up before we did that. But one of the questions I asked him was, what do you consider your primary instrument? And he said, whichever one he's practicing for his next gig. I think if you push him a little bit further, like what is the instrument that he gets hired the most on? And he would probably tell you it's the oboe or the oboe family, the oboe and the English horn. But he plays all of the woodwinds and he has played all of them professionally, that is for paid gigs. He also plays all of the orchestral string instruments. And I know that he's been hired for at least two of them professionally for paid gigs. I think he plays some percussion. We haven't actually talked about that. I don't know if that's one of his stronger sets of instruments. But the only thing that I don't think he plays much of, at least last check, is instruments from the brass section. But he also plays keyboard instruments. He has a doctorate in multiple woodwind performance. He teaches full-time at a local college. He's a regular member of more than one orchestra and talks about some other groups that he's been in. But we have really a two-in-one episode today. The first two-thirds or so is all about the mindset and the physical approach that Ron takes to learning new instruments. We even talk about one that he's currently learning in addition to ones that he's already learned before. And then the last third of this episode, we'll get into a little bit of a sensitive subject, but one that I think is really important, one that Ron was willing to talk about, and I wanted to give him a voice for that. So it's not really a conversation, because I can't say that I add a whole lot to it. But in addition to everything that I said before, Ron is a black musician who plays classical music. And this is something that is still met with resistance from certain individuals in our society. It's long been perfectly acceptable for a black musician to play at the highest level in other genres, and we don't even have to name what they are, but classical music is one of those where we're still probably many decades behind other parts of our society when it comes to social improvement. Ron's going to talk about what it's been like for him, but it's not all discouraging, because Ron also talks about some of the opportunities that have come about for musicians of color. So this is an interview chock full of things that we're going to be talking about, and let me not delay any further. Here's my conversation with Ron Ford. So Ron and I are having a conversation on the day that Instagram and Facebook went down and, you know, sharing a sigh of relief that as of today, we have not been hacked. So otherwise, how's your day going today, Ron?
Other than that, it's going pretty good. In kind of a relaxed day. I'm on spring break, so I'm enjoying my time off from school for a week.
Nice. Where are you now, and what courses are you teaching?
So I'm now full-time at Guilford Tech, Guilford Technical Community College, where I'm teaching Music Theory 1 and 2, Oral Skills 1 and 2, Applied Woodwind and String Lessons. What else am I teaching? I'm helping with the jazz band. I am assistant directing with the Titan Civic Band, which is a community band in High Point, and introduction to jazz courses. So I'm kind of covering a lot of ground.
Nice.
And I'm also at A&T teaching supplied woodwind classes. So oboe students this semester, flute, clarinet, and saxophone students this semester.
Nice. So for anyone confused, you know, the episode will say that you're Ronald Ford, but I know you as Ron. In fact, yeah, I think even you have a thing we've talked about before on Life in the Pit back on episode 15. If anyone, I would encourage everyone to go check out that episode, because we'll probably cover some of the same ground, but not all of it. But, you know, we talked about the Ron Ford Orchestra then, you know, your YouTube project, and I think your last one, I don't remember what piece it was very ambitious.
It was that, oh goodness, what was this one? Yeah, they've gotten bigger and bigger and bigger lately.
Right.
And I'm trying to learn some harp parts, as you can see my harp in the background,
nice.
For some other cool projects I want to do with it, but I guess I hadn't had time to. Learning pedal harp pieces on lever harp is very interesting and very tedious.
Right. Well, the harp is, you know, it's an interesting instrument because it can play all of the notes, you know, all of a chromatic scale, but it's not a chromatic instrument because you can only have seven at a time, you know. Yeah. So that's one of the things that we're talking about today. We're talking about, you know, just learning other instruments. So, you know, I was gonna throw out a hypothetical example of an instrument you might learn that you haven't already, but maybe we'll start with the harp here. So we're gonna backtrack in just a moment. We'll talk about all the instruments that you have played and how you keep them in rotation. But you know, for those who want to learn an instrument, it's just good to get some examples of people who have really successfully learned other instruments. So what's your strategy with learning the harp right now? Like, what are some things that you have done? What are some things you plan to do?
So I've read a lot of books for me. Luckily for me that I have played other instruments, so this is not me starting off completely. This is kind of me adding on to my musical abilities, I guess. So for me, it's been a journey of doing some reading on technique, because I actually do understand reading technique, and getting some hints and helpful tips from harpists in the area. So Winifred Garrett and I have been chatting a lot, and I need to figure out some time to go take lessons with her. But, you know, going and finding a harp teacher and getting some help there. But a lot of it was just me starting off and, like, exploring and, you know, reading a little bit and understanding technique and, like, getting to the instrument and going, okay, this is what they're saying do. Let me try to get my fingers to do this. And if that didn't work, I'd actually go to someone.
Right.
So that's been a lot of it, though. It's been trying, failing sometimes, hopefully not developing bad habits. And then even recording myself and showing them to other harpists and saying, and having them say, "Oh, that's great, do this instead, or try this, do this with your hands," and or, you know, I just with woodwind players a lot of times, like, do this with your embouchure, you know, try doing this. I can hear that you're doing this. So working with people that are, you know, play the instrument has been kind of my biggest helpful hint.
Do you do method book exercises, or do you kind of rely on improvisation as far as like early stuff?
Usually early stuff, I find whatever method books I can find. Some of these are treatises on harp that are available on IMSLP. Others are method books that I've been able to find or buy. Other method books that are available online. And yeah, it has been working. The biggest thing is always for me has been working slowly because, you know, I'm an adult learner, right. And having already, you know, a preconceived idea of what this is supposed to do in my head, I want to go that quickly.
Right. Right. I guess there's not a Rubank or Ed Sueda method for harp or anything like that, is there?
Right. Nothing as regimented in a large group setting, like, you know, all the band books have, where you can, you know, take a band book for various instruments and you've got a regimented thing that works for everyone from day one until however quick or slowly you want to work to an instrument. But harp is, there's a lot more variety of options, I think.
So, you know, not assuming everyone will go listen to the Life in the Pit episode, let's maybe just do a brief overview of some of the things that you got that got you into music. So, you know, I best know you as a reed player, and right. You know, so clarinet, flute, double reeds. I believe, like, you know, oboe is kind of like your featured instrument among that family, but you were also, you played violin and you've picked up the other strings as well. But like, what are your earliest instruments that you, you know, I hate to use the word master, you know, I was just, you know, my wife Jennifer and I were talking and we're saying, is there really such thing as advanced? Because you never get to, you know, a level where you just can play everything, you know. It's just like there's always you're approaching it. It's oh, right. It's like trying, yeah, to approach infinity almost. It's like you get seems like you get closer, but not really. And it's like you're always working. So but with the idea that, you know, you felt like, you know, you were pretty strong on most things. What are some of the first instruments that you worked on?
So I guess my first serious instrument was violin. In fifth grade, I started playing violin. That's the one I felt like I was connected to. I played piano before then as a kid, you know, for 3 years, and wasn't the instrument I wanted to make sound with. Right. Sorry, pianists. But I, violin kind of spoke to me at the beginning, and I was a very serious violinist all through middle and high school. And, you know, even in college, I was playing violin, but just not studying it. All throughout middle school, I learned all the string instruments. So I just picked up an instrument a year. I played cello in sixth grade because everyone else was already starting out brand new, and I decided to start off with a new instrument. And then someone taught me to read alto clef in seventh grade, so I picked up the viola, right. which is kind of dangerous, I guess, for me. And then I somehow, I don't know how this happened, but I just picked up bass somewhere in high school, in middle school also, just by osmosis, I guess. I was always that kid that was listening to everyone else as a teacher was telling them how to do stuff. So I always internalized what they were doing. So I just kind of ended up picking up the bass by listening. And then my teacher asked me to go help the bass players one day, and I started playing. Mm-hmm. Let me know if the dog's in the background also.
It picks up, but it's all right.
Okay. Our new dog is a part pit bull and has that howl.
That's fine.
So then in high school, I picked up the oboe because I wanted to learn a new instrument, and that's what the band director had left. So I decided to learn oboe, and I kind of fell in love with this idea of being a solo instrument. Playing violin was great, but I didn't like being what I called the herd, being a part of a large violin section, you know, all playing the exact same thing. And I've been in some orchestras where, you know, I was playing in a section and the first, the one of the principal or concert master did something wrong and everyone else followed them off the cliff. And I just said, no, that was the wrong rhythm. That was the wrong note. I'm going to go the right way. And, you know, I get looked at like I was the weird one there. All of a sudden I realized, oh, no, that was the right note. So I have learned that I am not the one to always follow someone. I will play with people happily, but I'm not going to follow you if you were, you know, wrong or right. Usually I will, you know, I'll make sure that we're playing together, but I'm not going to, you know, play the wrong notes just because you played the wrong notes. So oboe was something that spoke really well to me. And I love this idea of being a solo instrument. Like no one else is playing my part. So the wind section as a whole kind of spoke to me. So I learned oboe in ninth grade, picked up flute and clarinet in 10th grade. I was playing in the youth symphony in ninth grade on oboe all through high school, and that kind of became like the solo instrument for me. I picked up bassoon in, I think, 11th grade and saxophone just because I wanted to play in jazz band. And, you know, got to be kind of the jazz band's flutist and saxophonist. I was the oboist in the, you know, wind ensemble at school and in the youth orchestra. I was doing gigs in high school on violin and viola. So I was kind of working as a musician already, you know, at a pretty young age, and kind of saw how my kind of skill set kind of worked around my career. Or at least future career. I wouldn't say call it a career yet, but it was starting to become something at that age.
Right.
And then, yeah, I guess kind of took off from there. I did my bachelor's, master's, and doctorate in oboe performance. I picked up multiple woodwinds as a cognate during my doctorate and got some formal studying on the wind instruments. Even took a viola lesson with the viola professor at school because he found out I played viola.
Right.
And he cornered me, in the hallway, but he stopped me in the hallway where all the graduate students were eating in this little area by a window. And as he's passing by to go to his office, he stops and says, "Ron, you played viola. I heard about this from a friend of ours. And so you're taking a lesson with me." So I said, "I'll figure out what to play." So I ended up taking a viola lesson with him through school, and it got me some really good technique on my right hand. And yeah, it was kind of finding how to navigate studying the different instruments was the fun part and kind of the funky part for me.
It's always nice to have a teacher, you know, like the viola teacher in a school. Like I don't know if I was my freshman or sophomore year, but the organ teacher, you know, he just said, "Have you ever played organ before?" And I said, "No." And I didn't have him for any class. He just knew that I was kind of new there. I was a, you know, piano and composition major, well, piano student, not a piano major, but a composition major. And he's like, can you make time at like 12 o'clock on Tuesdays, you know? And he gave me a free 30-minute lesson for about a semester. And, you know, because it was free, there were times where like one of us would take off, you know,
right.
and all that. But, you know, it was very handy because, you know, just organ is one of those things that's kind of hard to learn without a mentor because there's just so much weirdness to it.
Right.
Now, just talking about woodwinds, I don't think I've ever really asked this, even on Life of the Pit interviews, but, you know, I have enough woodwind experience to know that the embouchure or, you know, the mouth position that you use for an oboe, a clarinet, and a flute are all very different. In fact, it was a relief to me as a brass player to get to the oboe because I could finally use lip pressure, you know, and not have it be a problem. It just killed me on the clarinet. You know, it's like, cause it took me probably half a semester of study before I stopped like just squeezing the reed to death, you know, with my mouth and allowed it to play to where it was only squeaking, you know, about 10 or 20% of the time, you know, instead of 80 or 90% of the time, you know. So, and then flute, you know, there's nothing to hold on to. It's like, it's just, you're just blown over a hole and you're, you know, I would say after 2 weeks, I stopped feeling like I was getting high and wanted to faint, you know. But And people said it's like blowing over a Coke bottle. And they told me that when I started, you know, and I thought, you know, I've never blown over a Coke bottle. So I started practicing that when I didn't have a flute in my hands, you know, and that kind of helped. But how hard have you found it to adjust, like when you were learning the instruments, to learn the new embouchure? Was that hard for you, or did you have any tricks that you found that were helpful?
For me, it was not too difficult. I kind of compartmentalized everything. So when I was learning flute, I turned off what was my oboe brain, and I kept the musician brain on, or at least the part of me that's a musician, but I turned off what was oboe specific and just kind of put it away and took to the flute as if it was a brand new instrument. I kept my knowledge about music in general, you know, intact, but I let that feel like a brand new instrument, like I was learning it from the start. So I didn't come in, oh, well, this is what you do on oboe. I wonder if this works on flute. It was, this is what you do on flute. Let's not even worry about the other instruments. They don't really relate to each other. And I guess that might have been helpful because I started as a string player. So going to the wind side, you know, I didn't have any sense of I need to carry my violin studies over to oboe playing. So when I started playing oboes, it wasn't like I was carrying anything over. So when I started playing flute, I didn't carry anything over. When I started playing clarinet, I didn't carry anything over with me. I kind of left those instruments where they were, in that compartment of my brain, and went to a whole new shelf and created a new place for the new instruments. So I think that allowed my muscles to develop in a way that didn't rely on what was going on with the other instruments. But even now as a teacher, I find myself starting students solely on what their embouchure is doing. In a lot of times for my first couple of weeks of lessons, especially when they're brand new, is embouchure only. If it's a flute player, we're playing on the head joint only. If it's a clarinet player, we're playing on the reed and mouthpiece only, maybe the barrel. But saxophone players, you know, mouthpiece and reed, maybe the neck, bassoon players and oboe players, reed only, and working and getting those muscles built up so they're creating the correct pitch, they're creating the, you know, correct sound, they're not biting, they're not pinching, they're allowing themselves to really get the full resonance that they want from the instrument, from just the small part of the instrument. And then finally I say, all right, now we can add the fingers. So when I was learning flute, I remember starting with just the head joint for a while, getting very lightheaded, like you said. Mm-hmm. Yep. I was sitting at home. I remember sitting in my living room. I just came from school, had the flute in my hand. I didn't even get all the way to my room yet. I said, I'm going to stop here, and I got to pull the flute out, and I got to play it. So I walked in the house maybe 2 feet and put the flute, the case on the couch, and then open it up, take the head joint out, and try to make sound with it. But yes, at first it's very difficult because, I wasn't too young. I didn't have any kind of preconceived notion of how this should sound. But I was also still in this kind of malleable state that I could kind of go with the flow wherever I needed to go. I wasn't stuck in one way of doing things. Which is kind of nice. So I was, at this age, I had the maturity to understand, I know what flute's supposed to sound like, but I also had the maturity to understand that I have an idea of how to make that happen after listening to a lot of really good flutists, between youth orchestra and high school orchestra and, you know, all county and district bands. I've listened to some really good flutists over the years that were just in my peers, not even like professional players just yet, really. But my peers that I was around, I got kind of a really a few feet away understanding of what their sound felt like, instead of listening to a recording, which is, you know, recorded however far away in the hall, the microphones are set up.
Right. You had a couple of things that really stood out to me that you said there. One was turning off your oboe brain when you were learning the other instruments. I know when I first had to learn alto clef for like freshman theory or whatever, you know, my freshman year, mm-hmm. I, like probably many others, figured out, if I just take what it would be in treble clef and transpose it up a step, I've got the right letter. So it's like, it looks like a B, it's a C, or it looks right. like a C, it's a D. And one of the teachers, as if they could read my mind, you know, it was probably, you know, several weeks later, they said, while you're learning alto clef, don't compare it to another clef. Mm-hmm. Learn it as it is. Just make yourself not even compare, but learn it as it is. And I did that. And it was probably that, I said a few months later, it was probably like, it might have even been my junior year. We had a class called Reading and Transposition. I don't know if you had anything like that, but it was a really difficult class that I'm so glad that I took. But we had a book where we had to sight read things, but sometimes it would be like three staffs of music, all in different clefs and not necessarily in high to low order. Like you might have the alto right. clef on top and the treble clef in the middle or on the bottom. And it's just like, and you're just doing your best to unscramble this. And I think he said at the beginning of the class, your transpose trick will not help you. You know, you've got right. to see the clef as it is. And so I really worked on that. So that's very helpful. And then the other thing, it was one of the last things, you know, you talked about was you'd heard really good flutists. I think this is an under-mentioned, I think when you reach a kind of professional musician status, there are some things that you take for granted that you don't realize that, like, a lot of music students in their early stages are not doing. And I feel like a lot of earliest classical music students are not listening to classical musicians. You know, it's like I couldn't imagine that I would ever encounter like running a youth basketball league where they weren't watching the NBA. But
right.
And I don't think, you know, guitar teachers probably don't have this problem. Like they probably are not teaching like all these Jimi Hendrix, Van Halen tunes to people who never listen to really good guitarists. But the average piano student probably cannot name a good pianist, you know, out there, and have probably never sat down to really watch. They just know, like, their friend is taking lessons. They may have learned something like, you know, for Elise, you know, they may have seen one of their friends learn, like, you know, the opening eight measures or 16 measures, that mm-hmm. kind of self-taught and all that. But they're, you know, most of them, like 95% or more percent of them, have never seen a really good pianist, and I'm like the best one that they've ever seen whenever I play for them. And, you know, that just seems like, I don't know how that is for woodwinds and strings, you know, how many people are just not going there. But it's so important to listen, you know, to examples of your instrument being played well, but then also use this wonderful resource called YouTube and go and find these professionals playing your instrument.
Yes. You know, back in my day, you know, when we were younger, finding recordings was actually a feat.
Right.
You had to actually go find them. Or, you know, my mom was great and took me to the symphony concerts here in Greensboro pretty often. And my teachers also encouraged me to go to them. So they oftentimes would get, you know, discount tickets through the school or through the symphony, would, you know, do rush tickets every now and again, or, you know, something, they would have student tickets available. So my teachers always found ways for me to have tickets to go to the symphonies. The Youth Symphony often gave us tickets. I, you know, found ways to hear great players. My mom would take me to see, you know, recitals sometimes even. Like I remember going to a piano recital down at the Carolina Theater, just because, for no reason, my mom just said, we're going to go see this recital. We're going to go see this pianist go play. So I remember having those experiences that kind of helped shape my kind of musical ear. I had great musicians in my family too, like distant relatives, but they were there, so I was always encouraged to play. But yeah, that was one of the things that was very helpful in developing a good musical ear, was listening to a lot of people. Even now, I still listen. Like, as I'm playing with my colleagues in the symphonies, I'm always listening to them and going, all right, when I get back to my flute, I'm going to figure out how they did that.
Right.
When I get back to my clarinet, I'm going to figure out what they did there, because that was amazing. And I have to understand that. And I'm already internalizing what they were doing and how they were making that, but I have to like go home and now actually try it for myself. So I've done a lot of that even in more recent years. I never stopped listening, of course, you know, and I'm always listening to what some of my friends are doing. And then like one of my friends in color music, I told them that, you know, I'm taking a lesson with you when we're at our next concert series. We're going to be here. We're going to have nothing to do for a couple of hours here, you know, in random parts of the day. And I am having a lesson. I have no idea what I'm going to play it for this lesson, but I'm having a lesson because you sound amazing, and I want to sound more like you. And I want to figure out what you're doing to, you know, have this wonderful sound. So I would, you know, have those moments to work with some amazing people. Like in the corner, our flutist in Fayetteville did the same thing. She's like, oh, you don't need me. I'm like, no. I need to do what you're doing. So always, you know, having those great examples of great musicians around you is I think an unspoken tool that I think in our day, you know, previous years was very important to a lot of our teachers. Like we were pushing, you know, I need to listen to these recordings this week and these recordings this week, or find two recordings of this piece list by different performers and, you know, compare them. And it's just making me think of more things I want to do with my students now, having to do some writing exercises, short, you know, comparisons of performers. But I oftentimes do this in my classes, make students listen to different performers. And it gets them the chance to really understand, you know, what's going on and how these two different people are interpreting the same piece of music.
Yeah. Well, as you said, it is an important tool to have, to be around other good musicians. So, I mean, it's basically if you're the best musician wherever you are, you're never going to grow. You don't have a reason to, you know. But
right.
If you put yourself in a situation where you feel a little behind, that's actually ideal. It's like that, you know, after you get over, you know, whatever self-esteem issues kind of hit you, you know, but you realize this is a challenge and it's one to embrace. But the other tool that I would say that's also evident from what you said, and it's something that I've noticed in a lot of musicians I admire, is never feeling like you've arrived and always looking for ways that you can improve yourselves. Like, you know, in the world of rock, I'm a Rush fan, which I'm sure every time my former college roommate hears that probably laughs, because I pretended that I wasn't, because he played those albums to death. But I did secretly like him, and came to time removed from being, you know, in college, you know, in a roommate situation, came to really love that. But Neil Peart, the drummer of that group, he was probably considered to be by many to be the best drummer, you know, in a rock band on the planet in the early 90s, you know. And if it wasn't him, he was always in the top five of most lists. But he wasn't satisfied, so he felt like he could improve his technique and also expand his horizons by studying with a jazz drummer and just learning, you know, some working on his technique, and you know, and then it just polished what he was able to do. So I'm just fascinated by the idea of just continuing to seek, you know, to improve what you have.
Oh yeah, no, and we as humans in general, we never stop learning. And it's like as musicians, I feel like there's always someone better. There's always someone doing something amazing. And if we can find a way to harness that, it's always, you know, one of those great tools. And always, there's also composers writing harder and harder music that we all have to figure out ways to, you know, work around those new difficulty levels. It's always, you know, always fun for me to figure out like, oh, this is difficult. Instead of kind of shutting down, and my mind goes, all right, how do I figure this out? So that kind of curiosity has always helped me too.
Right. So let's go ahead and we'll go ahead and pivot. Now, this is something I was going to go on Facebook and kind of explore some past posts to help me prep for this, but obviously we're recording on a day where there is no Facebook. So I'm going to I'm going to give you some prompt questions just to kind of let you run with this. So, one of the things I know that that you've become a little bit more outspoken about in the past few years is the challenges of being a black man in the classical world and just being a black musician in the classical world. So these are, you know, it's still a thing where I feel like racially this genre is maybe behind some other genres. Well, I guess it's behind a lot of it, by quite a bit for some other genres, you know, but at the same time, like, I think there's still some people out there that are surprised to meet a black musician, you know, like, right. I haven't encountered those people in real life. I've encountered them online and so forth. And, I know that you've become outspoken about that. One of the things I know that there was some news, maybe 2020, 2021, you know, time flies, it's hard to tell, but it was, someone who was denied tenure with their orchestra. I want to say it was somewhere like San Francisco, but it could have been somewhere else that started with an S, but it was a black musician, and that kind of came to the spotlight. And I don't remember the details of that. It's been a little while.
Yeah. I think it was Kansas City.
Yes. Yes, that was it.
Yeah.
Sorry, San Francisco.
I've had this moment where I've felt invisible in certain places, where I'm not, like, I feel like I don't get to work a lot locally. I'm doing a lot of work outside of the area. Mm-hmm. And I'm thankful for those places that I feel like I'm seen at. Like in Fayetteville, I feel like I'm seen, I'm appreciated, I feel like they really find ways to showcase, you know, some of their black musicians, and some musicians of color, and, you know, of all different races. Like our concertmaster is Latino, and they feature him a lot on concerts, not just because he's concertmaster, but they also feature him in a lot of chamber music outside of his actual, you know, normal duties as concertmaster, and doing other things and outreach. I've been doing a lot of jazz performances with the symphony. So I've been kind of out in the community playing. We've been, you know, I've played two concertos with the orchestra in the last 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also been, you know, like, it's nice to be able to be not just in the background of the orchestra and, you know, in the back of the, in the, you know, in the wind section, kind of, you know, far back, but, you know, up in front of the orchestra and getting to play. It's nice to be able to, like, be out there, but I feel sometimes that I'm overlooked in certain places, and or I am found, and they're always amazed at the talent that I can actually play this instrument that, you know, I have a doctorate in. Mm-hmm. But it's always an interesting moment meeting someone who's, she's a black classical musician for the first time, or especially a black oboist.
Mm-hmm.
Because they never, you know, expect me to be an oboist. If a lot of people, if I say I'm a musician, they, you know, immediately go to like percussion, specifically being a drummer, maybe a guitarist, like in a rock band. But no, I am, you know, mostly a classical musician. They expect, even if I said, oh, I'll play saxophone in a jazz band, they'd expect that too, I guess. But, like, I'm mostly a classical musician that can moonlight as a jazz musician.
Right.
And it's kind of weird that people don't, I mean, it's not weird. It's interesting people don't think that first.
Mm-hmm.
Their first instinct is always a preconceived notion of what they see me. I mean, I guess the locks, the, you know, the beard, I don't know what part of that it is, but it's always been, I've never been viewed as an actual oboist.
Right. Well, you know, some of it, I'm sure, has to do with, you know, experiences when you're growing up. Like, I was in a very small town in Florida. Mm-hmm. In band, and you know, there were guys that played saxophone but there were no guys on flute. And it's like, first time I saw a guy on flute, it was in college. And, you know, and at the same time, I'm realizing how absurd my reaction is. I'm still like really surprised at that. And, you know, and now, you know, you don't think twice about it, you know, about, you know, a female playing brass or percussion or a male playing woodwinds. But, you know, it's, I guess it's just one of those, you have those limited experiences. And, you know, I think we don't think about it. Yeah, yeah. And I think
we're around it. But there are still a lot of people who think that, you know, flute is a instrument for girls and for women. Mm-hmm. And harp is only for women. And brass players should all be men. But there's many people that say that kind of stuff. But, you know, if you look at a lot of the top orchestras and stuff, there's plenty of men that are in these type of orchestras playing flute and harp. And unfortunately, there's not as many women playing the other instruments, but that's a whole other issue in these type of orchestras. But, you know, there's plenty of representation around the world, and even in this, just in the country and even in the state, of people kind of breaking those norms of I'm of this gender and I must play this instrument only.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's an underrepresentation in all of the arts. I mean, in film scoring, you know, I know that community really well, but I can count on one hand the number of really successful, like, black composers of kind of noteworthy films, not to go into the independent world, but just noteworthy films and television. And in fact, you know, I think one of the greatest composers of film in the 21st century is Michael Abels, you know, who's kind of you know, I kind of idolize him in a way. Just I have too many any heroes of such, but I'm just amazed, you know, he was a K-12 teacher in Santa Monica when Jordan Peele asked him to score Get Out at the age of 54 from just finding videos on YouTube. And I think Get Out is, you know, the best score of the decade, you know, for movies. And it's just, you know, so there's some examples, you know, but, you know, I think it is an underrepresentation. But you have posted some things. You've been in an ensemble that kind of highlights musicians of color, and I think you alluded to, it was like, was it Color Orchestra?
Color Music about Festival. That's been one of the, I think, the top two ensembles of all people of color. Gateways Festival is the other orchestra, but Color Music's been, I've been playing with them now since 2021. Yeah, 2021, 1, 2, and 3 for Sacramento. Yeah, sorry, I'm trying to make sure what years I started. Right. But 2021, I got to play with them in November to go out to Sacramento and be principal of their orchestra. And then I got brought out for the last couple of years in Sacramento got to do the last two festivals out in Charleston. Where they had the full orchestra and got to play a concerto last year in Charleston with them. And it was, you know, this has been another great moment of us, a lot of people, a lot of black musicians getting together and actually kind of letting our hair down and relaxing and feeling like we don't have to be, quote unquote, on the entire time. We can kind of just be ourselves. And I find that we play better because we're not having to code switch. We're not having to be aware of our surroundings as much. We're not having to worry about, you know, who's there with us and who's looking at us in a weird way. It's kind of one of those nice moments of being able to play and just relax.
Right. What led you to that opportunity? Did you meet some people online, or, you know, what allowed you to have that opportunity?
You know what? I am not sure of how they found me yet.
The Ron Ford Orchestra.
But one thing, I could be some of those videos. A lot of people from Greensboro were in that orchestra. So I think by word of mouth, and I think them needing an oboist, and I think there's four of us from the Greensboro area, that said, why not call Ron? He's literally up the street.
Right.
And I got the call, and, you know, I think through word of mouth, the videos that I've put out they finally got to see me, and they said, "Oh wow, this just get him out." And then hopefully I've impressed him enough to keep me on as principal. But it's been a joy to play with this group, and even though the orchestra changes a little bit every time, it always feels like we're like a family kind of group, kind of organization. And it's one of those moments where we get to play together, and the music's great. Now, you know, that's fun, but I think some of our biggest draws to it is like the experiences that we did to have, you know, back at the hotel, all hanging out together, sitting in the lobby and just talking and eating together, and, you know, going to find good food together and just having the communal experience. As much as the music part of it is, you know, a lovely part of it too, and amazing to get to play in this orchestra of people that look like me, but it is a large part of it is the communal aspect of it after we get done playing. At the end of a long, you know, 3 rehearsals that day, we would get back to the hotel, we all like get food from random places, and we kind of like sit back, and the lobbies get really loud.
Right.
Because we're all of a sudden, all 80 of us are talking at the same time.
Right. You know, just kind of regarding this whole, you know, the whole subject, especially feeling invisible, feeling seen, you know, as I mentioned, we talked on my other podcast, Life in the Pit, on episode 15. I would also recommend, it's worth listening to for everybody to go check out episode 19, because that was with Kania Mills. Mm-hmm. And Kania was a guest a year ago on this podcast talking about the clarinet, kind of giving an overview of that. That was an instrument spotlight episode. But she shared how she has felt locally, like particularly like being the you know, the clarinet concert master of like the Salem band, you know, and so forth. And just, you know, how it maybe took a while for that to be accepted. You know, it's just, there's a lot of stories like that for local musicians. But, you know, like all things, progress is slow, but hopefully it's progress, you know.
Right. Yeah. And it's there. Progress is slow, but it's, you know, it changes happening, and it's just iceberg levels of change. Right. But you know, things start to trickle down a little bit more, and flesh out ideas, flesh out a little bit more, and new projects come along and you get invited. Yeah. And like I said, it was like Fayetteville, some the groups that have us in there, and they realize, you know, our talent, they say, we want to showcase that. We want to make sure that people see you. We don't want you to be hidden in the, you know, in the back of the orchestra, or I guess the middle of the orchestra, but we're going to make sure that you're a prominent part of this group. So yeah, it's nice having, you know, a group like Fayetteville and a group like Color Music that actually kind of champion its musicians.
Yeah, and it's also probably, it's a bit of a, I don't want to say it's not a self-fulfilling prophecy. That's not what I'm looking for, but it's kind of a feeder going into the future. So, you know, I suspect that one reason there aren't as many colored musicians in the classical world now is because growing up, the generation that would be didn't have as many examples to see. So the more people like yourself that are able to show a younger generation a good example, the more you inspire them to create more examples for the next generation. It seems like that's the best way to just get more representation. And then after a while, even I think the most racist modern society, well, I guess there's no accounting for them, but I would say kind of the average person should no longer even flinch at any demographic, whether it's women, men, you know, or whatever the demographic is.
Right. And yeah, it's just, again, like we said, change is slow. Yeah. But you know, as we are kind of growing as a society, and more of us are out there, you know, we start to see and grow that audience, not even the audience, but also like the youth that are, you know, going into these instruments. I'd never seen a black oboist growing up. I there are a few black musicians that were in my life that were, you know, amazing, but I never had a black oboist come across my screen anywhere, anytime. So that was, you know, kind of a first to have when I got to go, especially for Color Music, seeing other, you know, a whole orchestra of black musicians. That was kind of a nice treat to have. Oh, I'm not the only oboist here. And even, you know, going to school, like during my bachelor's and master's, I was the only black oboist. My doctorate, there were three of us in the school, if I remember correctly. I'm not leaving anyone out. But it was, you know, we have an instrument that wasn't really broadcast to us as an instrument we can go play.
Right.
Playing, you know, saxophone was the big one. Playing clarinet was still, you know, fine. Even in like high school, I went to a high school that was, I believe, 99% black. And if not 99, it was 98. So
Right.
very close to being an almost all black school. And I was the only oboist. Well, sorry, there was one other oboist who was a flute player who was playing oboe kind of as a relief just to have the instrument being there, but didn't really want to play oboe. And we had one bassoonist. And then when he graduated, I don't think anyone else took up the instrument. So it was, other instruments were perfectly fine. You know, all the brass instruments, yeah, no problem. All the, you know, other woodwinds, percussion, you know, that was kind of par for the course, but double reeds were kind of the ones that were underrepresented in that group. And I think part of it is the, you know, the cost of the instruments. I mean, bassoons and oboes, there's been more push lately, but there, especially back then, there wasn't a cheaper option that was any good.
Right.
Where there were decent clarinets that were, you know, pretty cheap. There are decent saxophones that are pretty cheap, from the big name companies. But the beginner oboes were very poorly decked out, I guess is a good way to think about it. They're missing keys that were kind of important for the performance at any level past that kind of elementary beginning level performance. So once you started going above that, their instruments jumped up in price 4 or 5 times, and you have now instruments that were back in, you know, the early 2000s, late 90s, that were, you know, over $4,000, which now is with inflation, it's like in the 9,000s, in $8,000, $9,000. So it's kind of wild seeing how, you know, there weren't that many, because partially because of the amount of money it takes to be a musician on certain instruments.
And oboe is also one of those instruments where, you know, you either have to make your own reeds or you have to be friends with someone who likes making the
Yeah.
reeds. Yeah.
That's, well, at least for the American
Yep.
style of oboe playing. European style, actually, a lot of people end up splitting off into different pathways. Like you have your reed makers and you have your players, and they kind of split off in the middle, and the reed makers are supplying reeds for the players. And it feels like that is almost shunned here in America, but
Right.
looked after in Europe.
Right. Well, that could be a whole another whole other topic. So many things we could talk about, and you know, certainly, I am, you know, I'm not really qualified to be on one end, but it is something just to direct attention to something goes on because you know we don't just talk about classical music, but I feel like a lot of listeners are at least interested in classical music, if not. That's the route that they're going through to study music, and you know, and it is something you want to make sure that the representation in the orchestra is slowly but surely growing to show the actual representation that we have outside of music as well. And it's a long way from getting there, but as you said, hopefully we're getting a little bit closer.
Fingers crossed.
So what kind of projects do you have going on now? Anything that you can share? Anything that people can follow?
There's one project I'm not sure is public yet, so I'll figure that out and let you know about it too. I am in the works of having a couple pieces commissioned for the I Exist project. It's a project for queer musicians and composers. Mm-hmm. So, and we're going to hopefully be performing some conferences here and coming up and doing a little bit of touring. You can find me in Fayetteville Symphony. I'm second oboe in English Horn there, Color Music Festival. You can find me there as well. And see, and next month, when in April 2024 and in May, I'll be conducting a ballet. So I've started conducting also. If you, I don't know if you know that. in April 2024, I'll be conducting a ballet called The Hair Journey. It's about Black women's hair and about a little girl kind of going through this journey of different hairstyles. And it's a brand new ballet, brand new music. I'm working on hiring the orchestra right now and getting rehearsals together very, very soon. I'm still waiting for the score to be finished. That's right. How brand new it is.
Yep.
Nice. Because we're still coordinating the score with the actual choreography. So things are changing in choreography, so things have to change in the score to reflect what's changing in the choreography. But yeah, that's coming out in the very near future. So if you search The Hair Journey, and you'll be able to find that ballet. And hopefully we'll be touring that sometime soon too.
Nice. So when all social media platforms are up and running, where can people follow you?
You can find me on Instagram at Ron Ford Music. I'm also Ron Ford Music or Ron Ford Musician on Facebook. Don't really use Twitter that much. I'm still Ron Ford Music there, but I'm not really utilizing that much.
Right.
But yeah, and you can find me at ronfordmusic.com.
Nice. Yeah. I think Twitter was popular this morning. People going there to find out if Facebook was down.
Might have started using it again.
Yeah. It's like maybe it was Elon's plot, you know, take down Meta.
Cut a wire somewhere.
Yeah. Right. All right. Well, it's been great talking to you once again. So thanks for chatting today.
Thank you, David. Always a pleasure to talk to you as well.
And that's going to wrap up things for this episode. I did want to include one link we did not talk about, and that is I would highly encourage you to check out Ron's YouTube channel. If you go to YouTube, his handle is Ron Ford Music, and he has currently, as of this recording, has 33 videos, and he has done recordings of The Nutcracker, The Intermezzo from Carmen, Midsummer Night's Dream, Brandenburg Concerto, and several other things, where he is playing every instrument, and it's visually very entertaining, very impressive, as well as showing off all of the instruments that he plays. If you enjoyed this episode, I would be so grateful if you would share it with at least one other person. Let them know about the podcast here. And if you haven't done so already, it would be wonderful if you would be willing to give a 5-star rating and even a review if your podcast app allows that, especially if you are on Apple or Spotify. Again, that's going to wrap up things for episode number 65. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll be back with you again next week.